Godspeed with Carol and Michael Hollenbach, Sundays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom in an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Carol Hollenbach. David Ord is editorial director of Namaste Publishing, publisher of books by authors like Eckhart Tolle, Michael Brown, and others, renowned and transformative works that focus on presence. He is also the author of Your Forgotten Self and Lessons in Loving, A Journey into the Heart. His work and his spiritual journey have been inspired in large part by the classic book by Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, The Little Prince. David made a deep connection between The Little Prince and the persona of Jesus that transformed his understanding and living of life. David, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Glad to be here with you, Carol.
The inner work of transformation that releases us to love and grow is critical to the work of the Godspeed Institute, even as it happens one heart at a time. And you experienced a significant transformation in your life. Why don't we begin with where you were when you encountered the Little Prince?
Well, I had come on a very long journey by the point I encountered the Little Prince. It was a journey that began growing up in Yorkshire in northern England, and I had grown up in the Church of England, sung in the choir and that kind of thing. And then in my teens, I found myself really looking for an identity in about age 13, 14, 15. And so I listened to people like Billy Graham, and they sounded so positive, so like they knew the answers, you know. And so I shifted into fundamentalism and all of that, which I didn't move out of until I was really in my late 20s. And then
I didn't know
began
they,
a slow
they allowed
evolution.
Billy Graham in Yorkshire. Go ahead.
Then I began a slow evolution out of fundamentalism and started to really study from a different point of view. And that's when I began to come to an understanding of the sense of the divine, not as a separate reality, but as that in which all of us are grounded, that which is the heart of our being. And so it was in that journey of beginning to discover the divine within myself and within everything else that I came to the point of reading The Little Prince. And what had happened in my life is I had discovered the whole understanding of being present instead of being locked in thoughts about regrets of yesterday or guilt or of things that happened in the past or a lot of anxiety about what might happen next tomorrow and what will next year be like and so forth. And I had increasingly become a person who was really wanting to live in this moment now, realizing that was the way to experience fulfillment and happiness and so forth, and was struggling to be able to stay present. And it was at this point that I encountered the story of the Little Prince.
Thank you for that answer. Before we proceed into The Little Prince, may I just ask you, growing up in the Church of England, as so many people can relate to growing up in a particular parish or denomination, what was the difference that you found spiritually in your experience that were you not able to experience the divine in quite the same way?
Right. I was always looking for something outside of myself, asking a God out there to help me. And the really funny thing is, you know, we would sing hymns like, Since Jesus Came Into My Heart and All the Joy We've Got as a Result of It. But then, even in the same service, you might sing a hymn, Come Into My Heart, Lord Jesus. And as a friend of mine from Argentina once said, who was also a minister, he said, well, what happened between the first hymn when he was there and the next hymn when now we're asking him to come? And I think that illustrates what was going on in my life. I was looking for something that was supposed to be happening, but it wasn't. I was asking God to give me peace, and I wasn't feeling peaceful. I was asking for joy or love, and I wasn't experiencing these things. The difference when I began to find it within myself is those things were there in me already, spontaneously available. My difficulty at the time that I encountered the little prince was being able to sustain it throughout the day. And that's what the book brought to my understanding, how to do that.
I see. So you were able to connect for moments, perhaps, but to sustain it as you say, even for a day.
Yes, I watched that wonderfully funny film recently again, came out in the 60s, those magnificent men in their flying machines. And you'd see how those different early flying machines, they'd get airborne for 100 feet or 200 feet, but then they were back down again. Well, that was what it was like for me being present. I would get the sense of it and experience it at moments, and it was an incredibly wonderful feeling. But then I would find myself back locked in thought about the past or the future again.
Thank you very much. That's a great analogy to share. And so then, now tell us about your experience of The Little Prince, such a classic book. Many of us read it in high school, a sort of a children's book for grown-ups, as it were.
Yes, one of our editors in Namaste Publishing, actually, we both work in the same company today, gave me that book. Oh, I don't know, it's at least a dozen years ago, maybe more. And when I started reading it, it begins with a story of a little boy who's 6 years old, and he, by age six, all he can draw, he loves to draw, and all he can draw is boa constrictors. And he draws them from the outside and from the inside. And his ability to draw anything else has been completely stifled. Now, what I immediately saw in that is that at age six, when our formal education tended to start in those days, a little earlier these days, but back then about age six, we're already bound by society's boa constrictor.
Yeah.
We can't draw, for example, as the little prince will ask this airman when he meets him, as he's grown up, a six-year-old boy grows up to be a pilot, an airman, and the little prince will ask him to draw sheep. He has no clue how to draw sheep because all he learned to draw were boa constrictors. So I began to realize this was a metaphor for our lives. This is what happens to us. We come into the world as little children who are open to the world. We have all kinds of interests. We're fascinated by life. And gradually, society shuts us down. We learn not to trust our feelings anymore, not to follow our heart, and to just do sensible things. Now, I began to make a connection between what was happening to the little boy of six and the boa constrictor mentality. And what Jesus said about, he told the adults he met, he told them, unless you become like a little child, you will never experience the kingdom of heaven. And I realized what he was saying is, and he actually says, you have to be converted and become as a little child. And I realized what he was saying is, we came into the world as people who were full of the divine nature in the image and likeness of God. And then we learn to be the way the world wants us to be. We learn to conform. And we shut down to our true selves. So a spiritual awakening, which I would now call enlightenment or entering into consciousness, means that I wake up once again to that incredible person I was when I was first born and in those very early years of life. Mm. And the little prince takes us on a journey into understanding how that happens in our lives. And I have to say that it happens painfully, because when the little boy grows up to be a pilot, he crash lands in the Sahara Desert. And he has 8 days of water, and he will get all the way to the end of day eight with his water having run out before he will discover the amazing thing of a well right there in the desert.
Yeah.
Such a picture of our lives. Certainly a picture of my life. Of course, all kinds of things with jobs and so forth, where you reach a point of midlife crisis, which often happens much earlier these days, where you realize the person you've been isn't who you really are.
Well, yeah. That's true. And that's the
conversion experience that Jesus speaks of. That's being born again. It's not all this stuff that Billy Graham and others talk about as some sort of accepting Jesus or something. It's becoming an authentic person like Jesus was, like we were when we came into the world, before we exchange presence for pretense.
For role-playing, in a way.
Yeah.
Now, to your point earlier about the little prince asking the pilot to draw a sheep, I recall the pilot trying several times and finally sort of giving up and drawing a crate with two holes in it. And the boy being immensely pleased about that, and so the description of the childlike nature of God is seeing something or believing something you can't actually see into that mystery of he had the imagination for the crate.
It's not even really believing. It's a sort of an inner knowing. Faith, I would describe more as just something that grasps you, rather than something you believe in, which is a mental concept. It's something that just gets hold of you. And I would have to say that all my life long, I have felt this tug of the infinite, this mystery. I cannot begin to describe. All my images of God went out the window years ago.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of some being up there who I can talk to and controls things and all of that went out the window. And I began to realize that there is a ground of being, as the theologian Paul Tillich said in the 20th century, in which we are rooted. And our being is an expression, a manifestation of a single field of being that is a consciousness that our own consciousness participates in. So faith is me allowing myself to relax into that, to just trust it. It's not a mental concept. It's a letting go into it. And what the journey of the little prince and the airman does is the little prince leads him to the place where he can relax into it. And he can just trust it, and then everything begins to flow in his life.
Now, in your bio, I noticed that you mentioned hesitating to bring up the name of Jesus, as though it's like a conversation killer.
when we were doing my book, Your Forgotten Self.
Yes.
Constance Kello, who launched Eckhart's book, she founded Namaste Publishing specifically to publish Eckhart Tolle, The Power of Now and New Earth and so forth.
Yeah.
And then along came other authors like Michael Brown with The Presence Process and myself and so forth. And when we were doing the title of that, Constance felt we needed to say something about it being about Jesus on the cover. And I wasn't sure about that. I was happy to stay with just Your Forgotten Self, but she felt we should put it on there because people then would know what they were getting. So we put Mirrored in Jesus the Christ. But the moment I say that, so many people have got these images of Jesus that are nothing like what Jesus was like. He scandalized everything religious. He was a real person, so authentic that to be in his presence was an unmasking of people's pretense. They were taken apart at the seams. This is why he calls it being born again. It's that drastic. You realize that all your life long, well, think about the movies about this. I mean, I just think of a simple movie like Dan in Real Life. There's a guy who's been a certain way, and then he starts to wake up to himself as being different. Or maybe an even better example is the movie Chocolat. Because you get people in that French town who, from Vianne, who visits the town, to a woman who works in it, who's like a slave to her husband, and to the priest and the mayor of the town, all of them begin to awaken to realizing how they have been untrue to who they are. They've lived lives that others prescribed for them, fulfilling roles that aren't who they are at all. They betrayed themselves. Now, I came to understand that that's what Jesus meant by sin. And all of this stuff that so many churches talk about, you know, don't dance or don't party or don't drink or certainly anything to do with sex, all of that.
Right, some moral code.
People see that as being sin, and it's got nothing to do with sin. Sin is when we are untrue to ourselves. The word means, it's a word you use in archery, it means to miss the mark. And you're just failing to be the marvelous person you are.
Another film that strikes me as you speak is there's a comedy from the 90s called Groundhog Day with Bill Murray,
in which
he gets the same day over and over again until all of his superficial sarcasm and, you know, his whole attitude to the people, it just melts away and he finally reaches compassion.
Exactly. Now that's what Jesus means by being born again. You go back to being the original person you are. And that's the journey that the little prince and the pilot go on together in the Sahara Desert. A journey into authenticity, dropping all the rules, all the self-effort, all the need to try to impress other people, to try to impress ourselves, to prove we're someone. I have a friend who's 93 years old in England. He's a monk, Sebastian Moore. And he says in one of his books that he discovered that he was an endlessly apologized for self. Wow, how that fit me.
Yeah.
Endlessly apologized for. Always trying to feel okay, trying to do the right thing, trying to prove to people I'm okay. And when I finally gave all that up, realizing that that's what sin is, just the opposite of whatever. All of this moralism that people, this kind of moral Christian sort of life people try to live, that is the sin. Being true to ourselves is the life of trust, of faith, of just relaxing into the beautiful people we came into the world to be and have always been. Sebastian says in one of his books that the dirty secret of the Nazis is that they hated themselves. And if you look at all the things that are wrong in our world, they come from people who simply cannot accept and love who they are. They just can't relax into being okay with themselves. That's the sin of the world.
Yes, you're making me think of so many things right now. There's a line from another film, in our obsession with original sin, we forget original grace.
Exactly. Yes.
And how we were created.
We are grateful from the moment we come into the world. Look how delightful. Unless there's a pin stuck in it or colic or tiredness or something or it's hungry, a baby is just delightful.
Mm-hmm.
And we all are. And we stay that way, but we've learned to cover it up with this act, this pretense.
Now,
so
you
the
say
little
there,
prince's journey is one of shedding the pretense, learning to draw a sheep. And if you think about his attempts at drawing the sheep, which you were mentioning earlier, in one of them he draws a ram, and the little prince says to the emperor, "That's not a sheep, that's a ram." So part of the way we start to try to learn to be ourselves when we go through midlife crisis is we say, "Well, I've been a doormat all my life, or a mouse, so now I'm going to start being assertive." And so now we're doing the opposite thing. Instead of just being who we are, we're going to prove we're someone. And then he draws one that's sick. And you can see the sheep is sick. And how many of us as adults feel that way about our lives? Mm. We feel like we're wounded or we're victims. Or there's something wrong with us. We need to be fixed. None of those things are true. There is nothing wrong with us. There is nothing that needs fixing. There is just the original person we are, that graced person that needs to be simply accepted and exercised. Let me just be who I am. And finally, he draws the one that's created, and of course the one that's created is ready to go. It's ready for the flow of life. It's ready for action, and it's not thinking about things. It's sleeping in there. It's relaxing, letting life take it where it needs to take it. I would say that that's the great lesson of life, learning to relax into the flow of our being. And of course, that's the symbol of the well that they finally come across in the Sahara when they're just about to die of thirst. And they come to the well that has got the bucket all prepared and the water is glistening in the morning sun. And life just becomes a wonderful flow that's so different from the struggle to try to prove I'm someone.
Yes. Yes, and so much effort goes into that in our culture today. Could you please share, when you say there's absolutely nothing religious about Jesus of Nazareth, and share a little bit more about the real person that he was,
yes.
the real
well,
Jesus.
The people he attracted him to himself. If you look at people like Peter, Peter was a hothead. He was a fisherman. Now, you know, if you're a person who's worked the lake fishing, you're not some sort of religious weakling, some person who's just sort of like we do as clergy, you know, this pious sort of person. These are real people. Most of the people he attracted were people who were very down-to-earth, worldly people. So the religious said of him, they said he is a wine-bibber, translate that in modern language, he's a drunkard and a glutton, a friend of publicans and sinners, and the prostitutes and people like that. Now, can you imagine anyone that we picture today as a sort of a saintly person being described in those ways? I mean, are you going to describe the Pope as a drunkard or anything, or the Archbishop of Canterbury, or, you know, Jerry Falwell, well, he's not with us anymore, but Pat Robertson and that. These people are so opposite from how Jesus was described. But when the religious looked at Jesus, they saw a person who was the life of the party.
Yeah.
He had a great time. The most common, down-to-earth people. People who were outcasts of society flocked to be around him. They loved his company. He had a magnetic personality. There was a peacefulness about him that was so non-trying to prove anything, non-judgmental, not condemning people, just accepting them. Anyone who came into his presence felt totally accepted by him.
And he said, all these things I do, you can do.
Yes.
To those people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There was a love, a warmth, a joy, a spontaneity. He was just, I mean, you look at the way he was criticized by the religious people for, on the Sabbath, walking through the wheat fields. And his disciples started to pluck ears of wheat. And they said, oh, religious people, don't act like that on the Sabbath.
Right.
Well, they were out enjoying nature. They were having a good time instead of sitting in church. And Jesus was just a shock to people. He was a scandal. It was all his authenticity. Paul uses that term, scandalon, of him.
Now, you say that we might prefer a religious figure who's more mysterious to us because we don't want to meet our real self.
Yeah.
Why don't we want to meet our real self?
We have been so shut down to ourselves, we are frightened of our spontaneity. When you look at how spontaneous children are, they run, they shout, they scream with excitement, they jump up and down and dance. Michael Brown, in his book, Alchemy of the Heart, which is a Namaste publishing book, he wrote The Presence Process and also Alchemy of the Heart. And in Alchemy of the Heart, he has this wonderful little scene where he talks about when you were, say, a young boy or a young girl, maybe you were 4 or 5 years of age, and visitors were coming for the afternoon. And what you wanted to do was jump up and down and yell, visitors are coming, I'm so excited, and run down the corridors of the house and run to the door to greet them. And instead, you stand there very still and with a stiff expression, and you put out your hand and you say, hello, nice to have you here today. You know, he shows how society has taught us to behave in such stifled ways. So I think we are terrified of our spontaneity. To wake up to who I really am, this alive, vivacious, exciting, delightful, passionate, oh gosh, let's not even mention that word around religion.
Right.
You know, I mean, this whole, if you look at the creation, I mean, gosh, from the birds and the bees to the electrons and the protons and all of this, the entire thing is bursting with sort of a, it's almost like a gigantic orgasm. The whole of nature, it's all built on this entire thing of sexuality. Well, religion doesn't even begin to talk about the enjoyment and the excitement of life in these terms. This is scandalous to religious people.
Yes, and the joy of creation in all its aspects of new life.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
So now then, the Little Prince's journey helped you connect all of this to your experience of Jesus of Nazareth. Mm-hmm. We are about halfway through our program right now. I just want to say that you're listening to the Godspeed Institute on the Progressive Radio Network. We are talking with David Ord, author and editorial director of Namaste Publishing. And we are discussing present moment awareness. And in this segment of the show now, I'd like to delve a little more into specifically the present moment awareness.
Right.
And if we can get into your books more specifically, your first book explored or focused on how Jesus mirrors our essential being and calls us to awaken to our true self and live in present moment awareness. Can we get into that a little bit more in detail now in terms of not only the book and what you share with your audience, but also in terms of practice?
Yes.
As well. Let's start there.
Okay. Do we want to talk about how you become present or...
Well, let's start with first how Jesus mirrors our essential being and calls us to awaken to our true self. Let's get a little more into that in terms of your particular writing in that book and what you share and how it relates to the present moment awareness.
Well, when I think of present moment awareness in terms of Jesus, I think of his relationship with the disciples. Around the disciples, he was such a presence that they felt themselves coming alive to aspects of themselves, to who they really were, that they had been dead to for all these years. They started to find this whole other aspect of them beginning to come alive. But what was happening is they were borrowing a sense of self from him. It's when you're around someone who is really, really present.
Yeah.
If you're around Eckhart Tolle, for example. Now, Eckhart's a very different personality from what I picture Jesus being. He's more someone who loves to walk his dog in nature and that kind of thing. A quieter sort of person in that way.
Right.
But... when you're around Eckhart, you feel the stillness, the presence. It's palpable. And I don't think anyone could be in a room with him and not feel almost transformed by it. But what would be happening is they would be seeing mirrored in his stillness, they would be seeing mirrored their own stillness, so that they're starting to become aware of some aspect of themselves that they can't yet access. Now, I think that that's what was happening with the disciples. Around Jesus, they started to experience a freedom, a spontaneity, the ability to just relax and be at peace and to be joyous and excited about life that they had been closed off to. But it had not yet become their total experience. It was a reflected sense of self. And when Jesus was arrested, you remember how Simon Peter denied him three times?
Yes.
And we have often thought, well, Peter was just a coward. Or he chickened out. Sebastian Moore says that that's not true at all. And I have this in the book, Your Forgotten Self. What happened is Peter was enraged. Because here was someone who, hours earlier, when the Roman soldiers came to arrest Jesus, I mean, he took his sword out and was ready to fight for Jesus. And he had the courage to go right into the trial place where he was. So this is no coward. This is someone who, when he saw Jesus just meekly be taken like a lamb, was enraged because he thought that Jesus was going to take over the reins of government, create a revolution, and establish what he thought would be the kingdom of God. And he saw Jesus just not take that course at all. But I think after the third time he'd said so angrily, "I don't know who this man is."
He meant it literally.
Sorry?
I think he almost meant it literally from his outrage.
Yes.
Yeah.
And yes, exactly. Oh, that's, I hadn't seen that before. That's a good insight. Yes. I don't know who this man is. Yes, that fits beautifully with what we've just been talking about, in fact.
Yeah.
He started to awaken to this, but he had not yet come into this experience. So he didn't know this man. And then Jesus looks at him. And as Jesus looks into Peter's eyes, Peter, he realizes this is the same man he's been with this last few years. And he goes out weeping. What we've got going on here is Jesus has dropped the disciples on their heads, as it were. He has completely deserted them, and he disappears into the night. He's crucified, and they are left completely bewildered. Now, I think that is an image of what happens to us in life. We begin to become aware. It might be through the teachings of Eckhart Tolle, Ajahn Shanti, Janine Roth, her new books, Women, Food, and God, and Lost and Found. She was here in Phoenix the other night, and I went to hear her and to interview her. Just a real understanding of what presence is, the same as Eckhart's teaching, Michael Brown's in the presence process. You begin to be aware of this. You start to wake up to it, but you can't yet make it fully happen in your life. And I think what happens is, at that point, we just get dropped into oblivion. Something comes up in our life that shakes everything that we've got that we depend on. It might be a divorce. It might be a bankruptcy. It might be something like a loss of a job. We could lose our home. And we think a disaster has struck us. And in fact, it's just the opposite. We have crash-landed in the Sahara Desert. Or, to put it in the imagery of Jesus and the disciples, Jesus has led them on this journey and then just dropped out of their lives, and they are left floundering completely.
Now, the bewilderment that you mentioned, bewilderment also begins at the Last Supper, even, with not knowing what he's trying to say exactly.
Exactly.
And then being left, as you say, you know, with themselves.
Yes.
So would you say that we tend, when we're in this presence, to just sort of want to borrow it, but it really needs to become our own connection with our own inner self?
Exactly. And that's what crisis in our life, that's what the desert, the crash in the desert is all about. Do you remember in the movie Chocolat where Vian just finally... She's been trying and trying and trying, and finally she just is ready to quit, and she gives up completely. And she goes down to the bakery, and there are the other women preparing for the Easter festival. And I think that this is the experience. We have to come to the end of our rope. We have to come to the end of ourselves. I think this is why there's so much of the imagery in the New Testament is about death and resurrection. There is a death of the person I've known myself to be. Jesus says, unless you lose your life, you will not find it. So this whole egoic person, this person I carry around in my head, this image of myself, this concept of who I am, that I learned early, that is the boa constrictor mentality that so restricts my life, that whole self has to die. And it usually takes a crisis. I think with some people, it can happen without a major crisis. But I think for most of us, it really does take a big crisis.
Yes, and
in that floundering, we find ourselves.
Yes, and you know, 9/11 comes to mind, where we all felt this enormous crisis, and a lot of people returned to church, and a lot of people reached out suddenly, and their, you know, their daily routine was broken up for a while, and you know, there was increased empathy and increase in spirituality, and then again, as things seemed, I'm putting in quotes now, safer. Or there was a return to more normal life, a lot of it fell away again.
Well,
so,
I think you've just given us a wonderful image of what I'm talking about, because that's what it is. The 9/11 thing began, it acted almost like Jesus, like a mirror of beginning to awaken us to the fact that there's something better about us than we've been living. But we hadn't yet come into it for ourselves. It was a reflected sense of ourselves that a crisis like that brought on. And somehow the crisis has to become so personal that it takes us down to the suicidal point almost. And then, just in this most amazing way, as we let go of everything we have thought is who we are, as the inauthenticity peels off us, there is just a marvelous peace and this joy and this love of who we are. And we stop all attempts to try to fix ourselves. We stop feeling bad about ourselves. And we just come into the present moment right now, present moment awareness.
Now, let's discuss that right now, the present moment awareness, and how it can be sustained. Can you share with us about this practice?
I think there are things we can do to help ourselves. One of the things that has been most helpful to me is Michael Brown's book, The Presence Process. I was just privileged to edit a revised edition of that. And in fact, I'm now recording it for Michael so that we can also have an audio version in the months to come. But The Presence Process is a method Well, it's got many aspects to it, but one of the central aspects is what's called connected breathing. And that is where you breathe in and out without pausing between the breaths. It's not any kind of forced breathing. If you look at a dog or a cat and watch how they breathe, they don't tend to hold their breath like we do. You know, one of the first things we do when something shocks us is, and we hold our breath.
Right.
And we do it a lot in our breathing. We become very anxious, and as the consequence is our breathing isn't smooth. But in present moment awareness, you can intensify your awareness by learning to breathe. In Michael's presence process, he has you do it 15 minutes twice a day, once in the morning and then once either in the evening or late afternoon if you tend to get sleepy in the evening. And you breathe without pausing. It's just the in and the out very smoothly, but no pause between the in-breath and the out-breath. And that has a remarkable way of bringing us into present moment awareness. Those practices can help, but I would say that in my own life and what I've seen in other people, life itself, once we open ourselves up to this, has a remarkable way of orchestrating our circumstances to push us into present moment awareness. We have a friend from New Zealand staying with us for a few days at the moment, and I was preparing for a dinner party last night, and I was chopping up the vegetables and so forth to make a New Orleans-style jambalaya. And she commented, "You know, you look like you're just completely into what you're doing in preparing the food." And I said, "Well, I am." And we talked about the fact that you come to a point where you don't think anymore. And I think that is really the shift that happens. I can't tell you how it happened for me, because I used to think about everything, analyze everything ad nauseum, painfully. But life itself, somehow, as I started to open up to this, it created circumstances where the thinking just dropped away. And now I would say I live in awareness, but very, very little thought. And it's just a very peaceful state to be in.
Well, that's very interesting, because in our culture, things are focused so much on the mental and the psychological and everything being not just analyzed but even pathologized about life. And you found your life transformed by going in a different direction.
Yeah, and it's not that I'm any kind of particular example of a sort of a spiritual way of living. I'm, if you're around me, you see I'm a very ordinary human being. Emotions, I have the full gamut of it all. It's not about being a saintly sort of person. It's just that you're fully present in everything. Michael Brown in The Presence Process says it's about learning to feel everything fully. You get better at feeling. But it's present moment. It's if I'm upset by something, I'm upset in this moment. I'm not upset 5 minutes from now. Whereas before, it used to go on and ruin days, you know, if not weeks.
Oh, yes. And you know, that's interesting, too, because it brings me back to what you were mentioning earlier about being like a little child, because that is also their relationship, often with emotions, is very, very in the present, but not 5 minutes from now.
Tears can turn into laughter in a matter of minutes.
Right, or you know, tears, or what it all is felt, and then it all passes.
Yes.
You know, but underneath
that's what it's like
now. Yeah. And underneath it is
you
just
don't...
this sort of underlying joy or happiness of being here.
And, you know, you can feel sad about something, and yet you have the joy of being. Just as you said, the joy of being here. And the two can sit side by side.
Now, in the presence process, being awakened to our true self and recapturing our authentic self now in our lives, we bring also our authentic self then into all our relationships.
Yes.
As you say. So how does the presence process then affect, and present moment awareness affect also our relationships?
You know, I wrote a book before I became editorial director for Namaste Publishing. I wrote a book called Alligators in Evening Dress. And it traces one couple who have got a lot of difficulties and how she begins to find herself. And it traces them all through to the transformation of their relationship. It's available on Amazon.com, Alligators in Evening Dress. But what it does is you become where you are responsive instead of reactive. And Michael explains this in the presence process. If something happens in your life, you learn to use your head instead of losing your head. And that's been the big difference, I think, for me. Now, I don't do it perfectly, that's for sure. Relationships will test you more than anything else, especially if you go home for Thanksgiving and Christmas. You know, Ram Dass used to say that if you want to find out how spiritual you are, just go home for the holidays.
It's a barometer.
Yeah.
Yes.
But essentially, you learn not to react, and the reason is that your sense of self is no longer attached to the other person. There is a remarkable thing about this teaching of detachment, which is a Buddhist teaching, but it's also very much a teaching of Jesus. Detachment does not mean that I'm not profoundly involved. It means that my emotions are independent of you. And that is, in fact, is what allows me to become profoundly involved with you. If my sense of well-being is dependent on how you are towards me, then I'm going to be like the waves of the ocean, tossed up and down. But if my emotional stability is grounded in me, if I am deciding how I feel, so that I'm not like an emotional Siamese twin, who's driving the direction of this single body with two heads? And emotionally, that's how many of us are. We're like Siamese twins. Our emotional life is completely governed by the other person.
Yeah.
So if they're down, we are now down. And if they're upset, we're upset. And our happiness depends on the other person. When we become grounded in ourselves, centered in ourselves, then if the other person is reactive over something, we use our head instead of losing it, and we don't react back. And now, forming my own opinions, my own ideas, my own feelings within myself allows me to come close to you, because then if you offend me, I don't have to back off, because I'm not wounded by you. I'm not even nicked by you. I'm solid in myself.
So then, David, does this help you in moments, let's say, of conflict in relationships or dealing with people who are not practicing presence?
You can stay calm. That's the key. If someone is erupting all over the ceiling, you don't have to join them in that. You can see it for what it is and realize it's not about you. It's in them. And that allows you to be close to them. I don't have to react to by becoming angry. Let's take a case of a couple who've gone out to have a romantic, let's say it's Valentine's, and they've got someone to look after the kids, and they've gone out for dinner.
Right.
And they're having a romantic evening, and they're expecting to enjoy some passion when they get home. And on the drive back, the discussion comes up about whether the kids are going to go to one school or the other next year. Maybe it's private school versus public school.
Right.
And they get into an argument. And by the time they're home, they're both hurt and upset with each other. And now he's on his side and she's on her side of the bed, and there's no man's land in between, and it's don't touch me and don't talk to me. And what is the real feeling when that's happening? The emotion is stay on your own side of bed and don't say anything to me and don't reach out. But if you look deeper, the true self beneath the ego, the true self really is wishing the other person would reach out. And also wishing you could reach out, but too proud to do so. So the feeling that we experience is different from the emotion. Now, when we become present and aware, we are conscious of that difference. I can feel, okay, right now my ego is saying, don't reach out, don't speak. But my true self really wants to connect. And that's what allows the connection to happen.
Now,
awareness is the key to relationships.
Say that once again.
Awareness is the key to relationships.
Awareness,
nothing will cause you to grow more than a relationship. I know, as a person who was single for a long time, you know, you can feel pretty spiritual when you're single. But when you get back in a relationship, unless you've really grown, you find all the same buttons get pressed.
Right.
And I think that's the reality of needing other people. Because if we are willing to, other people become a means of a mirror for us so that we can self-confront. And Ajahn Shanti says that the ability to self-examine and self-confront is the key to moving forward in all of this. You know, if anyone wants some really good advice on relationships, there are some books that are just the finest I've ever come across. I know this man personally, and his name is Dr. David Snarch, S-C-H-N-A-R-C-H. And he wrote a book called Passionate Marriage, and then he wrote one called Resurrecting Sex, and he has a more recent one called Intimacy and Desire. And his books are just outstanding on the ability to be present in yourself and not reactive to the other person. You learn to tame the reptile in you and to allow your more intelligent side to intervene when you feel like reacting.
Thank you very much, David. We've got a few minutes left here, and I just wanted to ask, moving beyond the immediacy of our intimate relationships, how does the presence process assist us in moving perhaps beyond our fears toward others, toward people of different beliefs than ourselves, from other communities? It's so prevalent in the world, in intolerance and even threats of violence for people, but yet somehow all in relationship.
Yeah. Well, you know, in my own life, what it's done is made me become a lot more tolerant of people and a lot more accepting. I move in circles that are everything from Christian, Jewish, Buddhist, atheistic, to very New Age. And I hear all kinds of different opinions on things. I talk sometimes to people who are great believers in UFOs, which I'm not, and so forth. And I used to have an attitude of, well, that's just nonsense. Now I have an attitude of, well, you know, they could be right, because I don't know. And I think that those things that used to matter to me, that used to be sort of marks of my identity, no longer are. I don't do that perfectly yet, but increasingly that's the way it is.
I don't need beliefs to hang on to
for an identity anymore. Yeah. That means I can accept everybody. I mean, Islam is a very different religion from what I'm used to. But I have friends who are very connected with the Islamic world. They're Americans who play Arabic music, and they go to the Middle East a lot. And they have really given me a very different opinion of many of the Islamic peoples. Hmm. So I think you become accepting, and you start to realize that all of these things are sort of like looking at a chandelier, where you get lots of different lights sparkling from the glass. And who's to say exactly what's right on a lot of these things? I think the only thing that matters, it used to be so important to me to be right on issues. I think the only thing that really matters to me now is to be present in something.
Yes, because thank you so much for that answer, because being right, again, is living in that mental state. And so often our discussions on religion in the world never get any further because they're stuck in who's right and who's wrong. So before we get to the close of our show today, I'd like to just sort of bring you back to the beginning, where you mentioned God when you were younger, being outside of yourself and looking elsewhere for something. After this long and interesting journey of yours, who is God now?
I don't know. Isn't that funny? I don't know. It's a way of being. It's a way of experiencing life in which I just am being me now. And I have a feeling that when I'm being me, God is being expressed through me. But I have no concept of God anymore. You know, I go to the Episcopal Cathedral here in Phoenix. I grew up Episcopal, then left it for many years, and then, about 3 years ago, I started going back again. And I go because I love, the sermons of Nicholas Knisley are very, very good. They're very challenging. And he's a scientist, so you get some very good understanding. But I go a lot because of the grandeur of the music. The music transports me into this sort of mystical, infinite feel. And I sing those hymns I used to sing as a kid, you know, like sun and praise him, sun and moon bow down before him, you know.
Right.
And I think of that imagery. What is this mystery where sun and moon and galaxies and who knows, maybe even more universes? I mean,
yes.
How can anyone have a concept of God if they have any understanding of science? So I think for me, all concepts of God have gone. And there is just a sense of a feel of being caught up in a mystery that is my being, is expressed through all other being, and is so much more than the created order. I have no concept for it anymore. Mm-hmm. I just have a life to live increasingly in conscious presence.
Well, thank you so much for that answer, David. We're just about ready to close. Could you very briefly give us information, like perhaps a website where people can go to learn more about your work?
Yes, Namaste, N-A-M-A-S-T-E, publishing.com. Namastepublishing.com. I write 5 days a week. I write The Compassionate Eye, and which is right now studying Eckhart Tolle's book, Stillness Speaks. And then 5 days a week, I also write Consciousness Rising, in which we're studying The Little Prince and how it relates to daily life. And then you can find my book, Your Forgotten Self, on the website. You can also get it at Amazon and bookstores and so forth. And then unique also to our website is my book, Lessons in Loving, A Journey into the Heart. That's a 7-hour, 5-CD audiobook which unpacks the meaning of the story of The Little Prince, Lessons in Loving.
Very good.
NamastePublishing.com. Will also, you can get in contact with Michael Brown's The Presence Process and Alchemy of the Heart there too.
Oh, thank you so much, David. It was a wonderful conversation with you.
I hope to speak with you again. I appreciate it.
And thank you for joining us for the Godspeed Institute today. If you'd like to hear this or any of our previous shows again, or send it to someone, simply go to GodspeedInstitute.com. We hope you enjoyed the show and hope you will join us again as we continue to explore all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Until then, Godspeed on your journey.